and welcome to Through the Pinard, your conversational podcast talking to midwives around the world about the research they are doing to improve midwifery practice. This research can range from small quality improvement programs and projects to those starting partway through or just finishing their postgraduate studies, and to those that have been there, done that, and got the t-shirt. So settle back and enjoy the conversation. And remember, you can continue the conversation on Twitter after you finish listening. Thank you very much for joining me, as per usual. Can you introduce yourself, please?
Hi, Liz. I'm Mary Renfrew. I am now Professor Emerita at the University of Dundee in Scotland. That means I've formally retired from my job. I'm currently working only on projects that I want to work on, and we'll come back maybe to some of those, but that is such a joy, having spent the last 40 or 50 years, if you like, working in a job and in the system where I've just kind of done, as well as things I wanted to do, things I had to do. So I'm really enjoying, if you like, that freedom. I'm a midwife by clinical background. And I've been a health researcher, if you like. Now, I finished my PhD in 1982, qualified as a midwife in the 70s in Scotland. And over that time in between, I've worked in practice, a bit less in practice perhaps than many others. I've worked in research, I've worked in education, I've worked in policy, I've worked globally as well as nationally in the UK, and I've worked in Canada for several years. Really, I suppose the thing that is most important perhaps in the last 25 years is that I established the Mother and Infant Research Unit, which is a multidisciplinary research unit, and certainly the first in the UK multidisciplinary research unit led by a midwife, and possibly among the first in the world. And this is its 25th anniversary year.
Oh, wow, so congratulations.
Delighted by that. Still running, now led by Professor Alison McFadden, again a midwife leading a multidisciplinary research unit. So, yeah, over that time, I guess, we've published hundreds of papers and lots of books and PhD students and postdocs and all sorts of things. So, yeah, pretty mixed life over the last many decades.
You've almost summed up the whole of every possible career you could have as a midwife.
It's fabulous. And I love talking to students about what you can do as a midwife because, you know, you start off as a midwife and you know what you want to do. Usually, you know, you want to work with mothers and babies. And then you learn that actually to work properly with mothers and babies, you need a whole bunch of other skills and a whole bunch of other knowledge. And as you learn that, some people can then move along different tracks and become educators, become researchers. And many of those careers can mix and match. You can do some of this and some of that. And it's intensely rewarding and intensely challenging. I actually gave a talk this week to a student conference that I called Midwifery, the Joy and the Struggle, because, you know, that's really true. It's light and dark. It's joy and struggle. It's good and challenging all at the same time. And there isn't a midwife in the world who doesn't recognise that mix.
And we're looking at more and more, not only are we seeing from the woman's point of view, increasing in birth trauma and PTSD rates, but we're also seeing it in midwives. We're looking at, and this is pre-COVID, they're increasing in moral distress and moral injury, and even within their own psyche. And that's when you put that onto the system changes, and then you put a global pandemic on top of that, and then you put, which we're all going into, an economic kind of environment that we haven't seen possibly in 50 years, as somebody described it yesterday to us, that impacts on everything that a midwife does and their ability to kind of cope on the bad days.
That's absolutely right. And I mean, it should be no surprise to anybody that midwives' well-being is intimately intertwined with the well-being of women and babies, partly because, you know, they're predominantly women themselves and have personal as well as professional experience, many of them, of this life of reproduction. But also because they are so committed and involved in making sure that women and babies get the best care, that when that can't happen for reasons beyond the midwife's control, then that disempowerment of midwives is absolutely mirroring the disempowerment of women within the system. So it should be no surprise to anybody that there is something of a crisis across the midwifery profession in some countries.
And I think I didn't follow it on Twitter. I briefly saw it, that somebody was putting up, I think it was the Push campaign actually, had put a tweet out to say that we actually need more men in midwifery to redress the situation. And it was just kind of like the comments that were coming after that. It was like, no, I think you missed the point there. It's like we need the system to actually recognise the midwives who are there regardless of their gender. We don't need more men in there. But
yeah. I mean, the male midwives I know have, without exception, been absolutely terrific. I just agree with you. I don't like the implication that we need men to come and be the solution. We need a solution for the system, regardless. And, you know, for all women, for all babies, which a bit is my, I suppose it's a bit become my strap line, is for all women and all babies and all families. Mm. Because one of the things that has become really, truly clear to me, hugely through my work on the Lancet series on midwifery, that what is needed for all women, all babies, all families, regardless of the country, regardless of their circumstance, is good quality midwifery whenever, you know, they are in that situation. And it's that universality of midwifery that is striking and fundamental and essential, regardless of whatever sector of society you're in, and regardless of your circumstances, and regardless of who you are, you need the same thing. You need the same thing from a midwife who is there with you on that journey. And that universality, all women, all babies, all families, is really what we have to be working towards.
And it is so intersectional. It is kind of, there's not one thing you can pick. There are so many different things. And just because you're in a high resource country doesn't mean you're not immune to the same issues and same struggles, because in every city, in every suburb, there's always going to be people that have different expectations, but also different advantages.
Exactly. And regardless of your context, you can be in any context, as you say. You can be in Bangladesh, you can be in Vancouver, you can be wherever. At the point where you need a midwife, you need that same thing. You need those midwifery skills. And that doesn't differ. The resources around that, the social care around that, your different needs for different levels of obstetric care, all of that will vary depending on who you are and where you are. But your fundamental unvarying need will be for those midwifery skills. Yeah. And I think it's that we have to be really clear about, that all women, all babies, all families, all countries need a midwife there with them on their journey.
So what got you into midwifery then, way back in the 70s? I mean, the high kind of starting to get into radical feminism was kind of coming back up after the sexual revolution of the 60s. So what was midwifery like starting back then? Because it'd be very different to what it is now.
It was very different. It was, yeah. Contextualise it just for a minute then. 1972, I started at the University of Edinburgh doing my nursing studies degree. Mm-hmm. Now, actually, that was the first nursing degree in the country.
Wow.
Up until then, nurses, of course, did hospital training. Mm-hmm. And it was such a valuable thing to do. It was a joint degree with social science. And it was 4.5 years, and we did community nursing at the same time as we were doing our general nursing. That's all part of that degree. And I really, really learned. Our lecturers were talented and committed. They were actually the pioneers of, if you like, nursing degree education and, as it turned out, of nursing research. And so I was taught evidence-based practice from the minute I was in the door. And I was taught the care of individuals as core and focus from the minute I was in the door. And I didn't realize at the time how unusual that was. I really did not know how unusual that was until I got out into the mainstream of practicing nursing for a while after I finished that degree. But I have to say, now looking back, I am forever grateful to the quality of that education. And I can't say I did midwifery because I always wanted to do midwifery, because that's actually not true. I did midwifery because it was at the time the next step that people did. Everybody in those years, if you were going to get on in nursing, got to be double qualified. Do your midder, it was called. So I went off to do my midder and had a bit of a shock. I did it in Edinburgh as well. Because although the midwives I was working with were absolutely tremendous as individuals, there were a whole lot of things going on that were very problematic. First of all, it was a hospital-based training, very different from my degree training. No evidence being used, really not that analytical questioning approach. It was, you know, here you are, this is what you do. But the problem with what we did was it was these routines in care that were just so hard to go with. So big antenatal clinics with women waiting for hours and hours to be seen, just kind of coming in and being put through like a conveyor belt. And when they were in labour, lying down in labour, routine episiotomies for all first-time mothers, and then repeat episiotomies for anyone who'd had an episiotomy before. all of that, you can imagine, it was a highly, highly medicalised system at that point in Edinburgh. One of the things that really got me was the way women were treated with breastfeeding, the way babies and women were treated. So it was, they were separated from the postnatal ward to the nursery. The babies were brought out every 3 hours or every 4 hours, depending on their weight. They were topped up routinely with formula, all breastfed babies. They were timed 2 minutes each side, then 4 minutes each side, then 5 minutes each side. So the whole thing was the watch, you know, the watch was the dominant force when you were breastfeeding. Basically, I found it very distressing. And interestingly, one of the influences on me at that point was I'd come from a very large family. I was at the big sister end of a very large family. And I'd seen babies breastfed just without any constraints or any limitations, and they seem to do absolutely fine. So I didn't get this separation and timing. It just jarred. And it was very clear to me when I went looking for the evidence, because, you know, I was a university graduate, and I went looking for the evidence, that that evidence either didn't exist, lots of it didn't exist, there was a great silence around this, but when it did exist, for example, one fabulous paper published in 1952 on the problems of timing feeds, it wasn't implemented. And very huge silence around the voices of women. There was almost nothing in the literature from the woman's perspective. So I got, with all of this, I got very, the only word I've ever been able to use about this is angry. That sounds maybe like I was not quite in control of what I was doing, but I absolutely was. It was a kind of cold anger. I really, really minded what was happening to women. Having said that, the midwives that were teaching me were wonderful, wonderful people. They were kind, they were compassionate, they knew their stuff, they were very experienced, they absolutely knew how to act and they knew how to care. But they were working in a system with those constraints. So I decided to leave midwifery. I was just off. I was going. I didn't know what I was going to do. And in that space where I was wondering what to do, my mother sent me an advert for a job. I mean, serendipity plays a great part in everybody's life, doesn't it? And this job was a research sister with the Medical Research Council, Reproductive Biology Unit in Edinburgh, looking at research in breastfeeding. I applied, I went along, I didn't think I'd get it, you know, relatively new midwife. And during that interview, my life turned absolutely around on its axis, because I was interviewed by three fantastic people who clearly understood, who cared, who knew the stuff, for whom evidence was absolutely essential. And what they presented me with in the interview was a world where I could really try and make a difference. I could get engaged in research with people of insight and compassion and intelligence. So amazingly, I was offered the job, and in a sense, that was my axis, my turning point. I think we've all got turning points in our lives, and that was professionally, that was mine. And that set me off on an astonishing four-year journey where I worked as part of a three-person team with an obstetrician and a reproductive endocrinologist and me. And they treated me as a member of the team. They didn't treat me as a research midwife to trot off and go and take the bloods. It from the start involved me. And I discovered all sorts of things. I discovered the importance of research, but I also discovered midwives ask different questions. Mm-hmm. You know, they would come in and they would want to know the answer to, what was going on hormonally for this woman and what were the blood levels doing. And I was going, well, what's actually her experience? How is she feeling? How's that affecting what's going on for her hormones? And so on and so forth. And we would have these conversations that actually hugely enriched what was going on. About a year into that journey, somebody casually said to me, why don't you do your PhD?
Yes, they do.
I said, well, midwives don't do PhDs, because midwives didn't do PhDs. There wasn't a single midwife with a PhD that I was aware of at that point.
Wow.
And I said, midwives don't do PhDs. And this great person who was a PhD student, doing some endocrinology PhD, said to me, why not? I mean, what you're doing is really important work. Why don't you do your PhD? That pushed all sorts of buttons for me. And cutting a very long story short, I registered to do my PhD with the full support of my team and my research unit. But I had to do it a roundabout way. There were no fellowships available. There was no funding support of any sort available for midwives at that point. I certainly couldn't afford to do a full-time PhD. So I had to keep working full-time. And the university would only allow part-time PhDs if you were working. They wouldn't allow you to do it full-time. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I couldn't imagine spending 5 years doing a degree. It just was beyond my comprehension. I wanted to do it full-time while I was working. So there was a wonderful organization called the Council for National Academic Awards at the time that supported people who were working to do further study. And they had a system where you could register full-time, where the university then actually supported you, provided the supervisors.
Oh, nice.
So it was like doing a full university degree, but they brokered it. It was basically for people who couldn't afford to do it full-time any other way. So I registered with them, but then had proper university supervisors and a full university experience. But I was working full time and had to still do that. So that was all good. I just didn't sleep for the next week.
I wonder why.
It was some of the richest years of my life. And we did all sorts of studies into breastfeeding. And the intriguing thing for me was, in that time, I saw the whole cycle of research. I saw the asking the questions, the generation of the project, the getting the funding for the project, the running the project, the writing it up, doing the analysis, the publishing it, and then the impact. The impact was huge at that time, because there was very little work on practical aspects of breastfeeding, mm-hmm. Around whether or not supplementation was harmful, around timing of feeds, around what the impact of test weighing, around the support that women needed and so on and so forth. And so we did a whole raft of studies. And what I was seeing was I saw them make a difference. I saw them actually move through and influence, for example, the development of the WHO UNICEF 10 steps that was happening around that time. And so I was seeing it go into practice and go into policy. And that was intensely important and really formed for me the foundation of the rest of my career, because I could see that you could do research and it could make a difference.
Yeah.
So at the end of that time, I got my PhD in 1982. As far as I know, it was the first, certainly the first midwife in the UK. I could certainly one of the earliest in the world. And that was that. So that was a long story to how I got into midwifery.
Oh, beautiful story.
The answer to how I managed to do my PhD. But the other thing for me was that my PhD journey was a total immersion in multidisciplinary working. It was a total normalization of the different skills that different people bring to the table. But because of the way my colleagues were, they totally respected me as a midwife. I didn't have to fight for that place at the table. There was hostility. There were very senior people around in the department and in the clinical setting who thought it was bonkers. I was told that it was bonkers that a midwife was doing a PhD. So there was hostility. I'm not saying there wasn't. What I'm saying is my own little team.
Yeah.
And of course, for your Australian listeners, you might be interested to know that the head of the unit that I was in at that point was Roger Short, who moved to Monash University not long after I left. And he was a reproductive biologist of very high standing. And he spent the rest of his career and his life working in Australia. So some people may well have come across Roger in that way. So I credit Roger with a huge amount of enabling me to do that work.
When you've got that support that's in your immediate support ring, it does help buffer the other waves that are crashing in from wider and higher around that kind of, yeah. And that's it. We still have that hierarchy. Midwives and nurses, you have your place, task orientated, not going there. And unfortunately, that's still prevalent in some countries with a very much a medical system and a patriarchal system.
It's very prevalent here too. Let me not say that the beginning and end, because the waves certainly crashed in my next stage and have been crashing ever since. What I wanted to do next, I guess, having finished my PhD, you said earlier something about what did I do to celebrate. I think you sort of yep. said that might be the question. I didn't do anything to celebrate, to be honest. I was exhausted. I was absolutely shattered. And in fact, well, I suppose what I did was I got a train ticket and I traveled around Europe on my own. I was really exhausted. Mm. And I didn't read a book for about 3 months. I didn't actually open a book. And I just got on a train. And in those days, you could get one of those European train tickets and just travel around. And I did that for 3 weeks. So that was fabulous. But then reality struck. I had to get a job.
Mm.
And I wanted to go back to clinical practice. So just because I felt, you know, quite distanced from it, and went and got a job as a midwife down in Oxford. where I was appointed to a midwife position on condition I didn't tell anybody I had a PhD.
You're kidding. No, you're obviously not kidding. Really? Why?
Yeah, really. Well, I suppose what she said to me, because they put this in my contract. I mean, it wasn't just don't tell anybody. It was don't tell anybody. Was she wanted everybody to treat me normally. And in fact, I think the subtext was she wanted me to behave like a proper midwife from her point of view. It was extraordinary because I then spent the next few months obfuscating, not being able, you know what midwives are like, oh, how are you doing? Where have you come from? You came to, oh, I know somebody who worked in Edinburgh. Do you know her? Where were you working? Were you in Labour Ward? You know, all those questions. Everybody knows
yep.
that you get asked those questions. And I had to kind of, not lie, but obfuscate.
Mm.
And a couple of people quickly worked out what had been going on. But about 6 months into the job, somebody discovered a paper I'd published and my secret was out of the bag. And what happened next was fabulous because they completely rallied round. Everybody, the midwives, the obstetricians, everybody rallied round and said, this is brilliant. Why do we not know this? They yep. were so chuffed. They were really chuffed. And then something extraordinary happened because it was a time when lots of things were being challenged in midwifery, the lying down in labour, the all sorts of practices were being challenged in midwifery. And what they then did was say to me, oh, you can answer these questions. So, you know about research. So what we did was we set up a journal club, we set up a discussion group, we took on a couple of topics. Routine rupture of membranes was one that we took on. Mobility in labour was another one. Mm-hmm. And we did worked up these, looked at the evidence and worked up papers on those kinds of things. And it was fantastic. And then they decided they wanted to actually run a study. So these are the general midwives around in various different bits of the system. And we designed and implemented, so we're talking here 1983, I think. We designed and implemented a randomized trial of delayed cord clamping. And we got the community midwives to do all the recruitment of women antenatally. We did it properly. We ran it through the ethics committee. We did all of that kind of stuff. We didn't have any funding. It was just the midwives were doing it.
Mm-hmm.
The labor ward midwives did the intervention. The postnatal and community midwives followed up. I mean, it was just astonishing. And we recruited something. We decided we needed a sample of somewhere over 800 to answer the question. We got to something like 600.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the consultants came along and said, this has to stop. I need to do this. I need to do cord bloods. You have to stop this trial. So there was great heartache there among the midwives. What did we learn from that? We learned a lot of things from that, as you might imagine. First of all, we learned you could do it. It's possible.
Mm.
And that paper has been published. If people want to go and look for it, it's the Oxford Midwives Research Group. It's been published as, not as a named group of collaborators. Until very recently, it was still the largest trial of cord clamping in the literature. We also learned that actually power structures matter.
Yes, and very much.
To get that trial running, I guess what we needed was also the wholehearted support of the consultants, some of whom were supportive, but obviously some of whom weren't. And when we tried to tackle him, he said, it's only midwives doing something that doesn't really matter. And now all the things we know about delayed cord clamping, you know, that was such a huge decision to make on his part. And it signaled for me another big theme through my life is, you know, coming back to this midwives ask different questions thing. We do ask different questions, but those are not necessarily valued.
Mm.
And it's about valuing. And it's also about being visible and not invisible. And if I can leap forward a bit on that issue to much later in my career, when I was the principal investigator for the Lancet series on midwifery, one of the things we discovered very early on, which didn't surprise me by that point, but shocked me actually, was the invisibility of midwifery in the world of research. So, for example, serious papers published in serious journals calling everything obstetrics. just everything. The 109 randomized trials of less skilled workers, community workers, and so on, and none of midwives in low-income countries, 109 versus nil. Those kinds of absolutely graphic indications of, at the least, a power imbalance, and at the most, a total invisibility of midwifery. And so that, although that story comes from, you know, fairly recently, of seeing that in the Lancet series, actually tracks right back to that story of stopping the delayed cord clamping trial.
Well, that was one of the things that I was going to ask, because, in fact, it's interesting because you are one of the few midwives who has her own Wikipedia page.
Not written by me.
No, no, but it, when I was looking at it, so I kind of, because Leslie Page is the same, she's got a Wikipedia page as well. And when you look at the categories, when you look at all the subcategories, it's kind of got down there British midwives, nursing researchers, academy, it's got nurse stubs. So when you go to their classification of pages, it actually goes into, so one of the stubs or the subcategories is nurse. There is no midwife.
No, and in fact, possibly we should be jolly glad that there is a category nurse. If you go into, I mean that very flippantly, because of course
it should be
for midwives, but one of the battles over the years has been the category, the keyword category on journals.
Yes.
Where, in fact, there's just nothing. There's just nothing that even relates to who you are or what you're studying. And it's been a great battle over the years for some of us who've tried to take it on and ask to extend all of that.
Well, I'm going to put a challenge out to anyone who has the time and the energy, but you can actually propose a new stub and you can actually propose a new name. So I want to challenge anyone out there to actually propose a midwifery one. And so we can actually start having that visibility become overt in this kind of like modern technology, and actually have a midwifery bio sub so that we can start putting the kind of people who identify as midwives under midwifery. Because 2020 here in Australia, Australia, New Zealand, we finally got recognised as our own separate midwifery research code. This is 2020, like the 21st century. We need to start taking that invisibility shield off and becoming louder and prouder, and forcing people to recognise us, because it's going to make it harder to keep making the changes we need to change.
I think that's right. And it's hard. I don't want to overstate this because, as I say, the joy and the struggle are both there. But it's hard to just keep standing in front of the tanks, you know, and to do that with a voice that people will listen to. And to say, actually, no, I don't agree with you because da 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 da, and to give it for reasons, for give it a rationale, to present evidence, to talk your way and work your way through that with proper discourse, and it's been that, I suppose, I've been trying to do all my career in a very kind of increasingly conscious way. As it's gone on, is to, there's nothing wrong with shouting loudly when there's injustice. I'm not saying that. What I am saying is that the path I've taken has been to keep saying it over and over again in words that people will listen to in a whole lot of different arenas, and to take the battle to policy, to take it to evidence, to take it to the big journals, to take it to education, to take it to practice, and to say we must do it this way because this is what the evidence says, this is what women and babies need. And so it's a keeping going. Yeah.
So part of doing that is that you've done the work with the World Health Organization and with global entities. So how did that opportunity come about, and how, because it is that balance of serendipity, things kind of put up, someone asks you a question, you're in the right place at the right time. So looking at the, and I'm thinking here kind of like with the UNFPA, apart from the Lancet series, but you've been involved in other global activities as well. So how did you get into those?
It is about being in the right place at the right time, but it's also about bringing the right things to the table. And I suppose between the bit of my bio that we last talked about back in 1983 and the decades into the 21st century, if you like, what I did was loads of different work in different places, different kinds of research. And I built, if you like, a portfolio, but also a knowledge base of a wide range of different methodologies, of different topics, and a foundation of knowledge right across the piece over those years. So moving away, if you like, although not immediately from clinical type questions, through to public health policy type questions and into large scale change. And if you kind of looked at the evolution of my research and my publications over that time, you'll see moving from things like perineal care, the Hoop trial, water birth, the very early days of water birth, through looking at the organization of care on and through really looking at nutrition and breastfeeding being a theme all the way through. Yes. I have never given up my absolute dedication and commitment to the importance of that. But actually really moving forward and through and learning as I went skills in epidemiology, in health economics, in qualitative research, in all the, I have always thought that the method you use should be the method you need to answer the question that matters. Mm-hmm. So the question you have that matters, that is the research design that you should be matching to the question. And because I've had the joy of working with a lot of fantastic collaborators over the years, I've been able to move with, you know, great support, for example, from statisticians or health economists or whoever. I've been able to move into a range of different methods and a range of different topics as a result. And so what happened over the years as I built that knowledge base was I got involved more and more and invited more and more into different arenas. So invited onto a funding committee for the Medical Research Council, invited into a policy committee to for the Department of Health in England, and so on and so forth. And so you build over time, you build your expertise, your knowledge, your ability to work in different worlds. Because it's not easy. It is not easy to work in a room full of people of different disciplines and hold your place at the table. It really is not. And you need to learn that. And it's nothing to be scared about. What I'm saying is that practice helps. Mm. So like anything else, practice helps. And as you do that and as you publish, so people get to know what your skills are and your abilities are. And I first actually got invited onto a WHO working group back in late 80s, when they were doing work on breastfeeding.
Yeah.
And my first experience of going to Geneva, working with the WHO on a document was then. They then found I knew about midwifery as well as infant feeding, because I've always tried to run the two strands together. And back in trying to think when it was. I should have got this clear in my head. Through the 90s, I also did some work with them. Oh, I know. One of the things that I did, I worked for the National Perinatal Epidemiology Unit for 7 years in Oxford, at the time that it was led by Ian Chalmers, and at the time that all the work on systematic reviewing was happening. It became the birth of the Cochrane Collaboration. And I was invited by Ian and Mary Yenkin and Mark Kearse to join them as co-editor of the Pregnancy and Childbirth group in its very, very early formation. The privilege and joy of that was immense. The struggle was huge. I had, at that point, two little children, very small children, and was running the National Midwifery Research Initiative for England out of the NPEU, and was doing all this work on the Guide to Effective Care in Pregnancy and all the systematic reviewing that went into the early days of the Cochrane Pregnancy and Childbirth module. So that also brought me to the attention of the WHO. I'm trying to answer your question, Liz, about the WHO.
Keep going. It's gorgeous.
Because I was involved in all that systematic reviewing and all that work in Cochrane, it was instantly seen by WHO. And then, of course, invitations to present and all the rest of it. So that happened through the late 80s into the early 90s. And then in 1994, I think that's right, I took up a chair in Leeds University, which was, as far as I know, the second chair of midwifery, but the first one that was mainly it was research, and started a program of research. So building on all the work I'd done in Oxford and building my unit. And that's where the Mother and Infant Research Unit was launched, as a multidisciplinary research unit. So basically, I worked a lot with the Department of Health, the government Department of Health in England. I'd worked a lot with the Medical Research Council. I'd worked a lot with the evolving Cochrane Pregnancy and Childbirth Group. And I'd already worked with the WHO in breastfeeding. And so it was a kind of step through, a normal step through, if you like. I also worked at that point a bit with the International Confederation of Midwives, and so on. Your network grows, grows. And as a researcher, one of the really, really important things to do is grow your network and nurture your network. Just try and keep in touch with people and build build those relationships and extend them and treasure them, because, you know, they matter. And I've said right from the start of my career that collaboration is the be-all and the end-all of good research. You cannot really thrive for long in the world of research working on your own. Not in the world that we live in, not in the kind of work we have to do.
Social media is going to be a good advantage to helping create those linkages, but also to continue those linkages. And I see it happening through the PhD Twitter handle, which was the kind of the birth for this podcast, is as it's growing and there are midwives kind of like globally that are sitting and talking and supporting. But I also know from experience that people are making connections outside and they've kind of like got into a connection, had a chat, and kind of 12 months later, they're working on a paper together or they're working on a review together. So they've started, they know the bios are getting up, they've presented or virtually. I've got two things I want to know about the Mother-Infant Research Unit. What has been, and I don't mind what order, you give me the answers to, what has been the most surprising thing in the 25 years? What has been the most challenging thing in the last 25 years since that was established?
Great questions. The challenging thing is easiest. The challenging, easiest question to answer. funding, money, 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 money. Everything runs on money.
Mm-hmm.
And we've never been in a situation where we've been handed core funding for anything. So it's all been on our wits, and you're only ever as good as the last grant that you got and the last publication you wrote. And the thing about research that I think everybody finds hard, some people find harder than others, is it's you're very publicly scrutinized all of the time. You can't hide. You don't go into research if you want to sit in a corner, because your publications are out there and people will comment on them, and your grants go to funding committees and people will scrutinize them, and they will tell you what they think, and journals will send you to referees and they will tell you what you think. And it's devastating. It doesn't get any easier, I will have to say, after, you know, 40 years in the field. It doesn't get any easier when people write really devastating things. And so, especially when they don't understand what you're doing.
Yeah.
That is a real problem. If it's somebody who's from right outside your field and they really actually don't get it and they write devastating things, you just want to go on. Anyway, the hardest thing then is getting funding to keep, because once you've got a group of people, you have to keep them employed.
Yeah.
Especially if they're really good, which they have been phenomenal all the way through. And especially if you've developed them over years and they've come to this point and you really want to keep them.
Mm.
And so then it's a constant struggle for funding. That's the hardest thing.
Mm.
The most surprising thing. Okay. The most surprising. I think partly I could be flippant and say that we're still here. You know, the Mother and Infant Research Unit exists.
Valid a statement.
Because when we set it up, it was really quite novel and we didn't know how long it was going to be there for. And, you know, we've moved it from Leeds to York for various reasons, and then from York to Dundee as well. So, and it has stayed intact and its mission has stayed the same, which is improving the health and well-being for women, babies and families, all women, babies and families, for informing practice and policy with evidence and for tackling inequalities. There's been an absolute human rights focus right from the very beginning of Meru, and an absolute focus on care for the women and babies that need it most. So, and that, although we've refreshed the program many times, although we've had new staff coming and through and going, has always actually been what people want to stay and focus on. So, yeah, that's.
You made the interesting comment there that even after 40 years, it's still difficult. When you get that lovely, as we know in research, reviewer 2 comment, how do you keep your resilience up? How do you keep your mental health up then? You've now got, now that you've retired, the absolute privilege of picking and choosing exactly what you want to go into, but you're still going to have ups and downs in there. So how do you keep your mental health kind of in a healthy space?
It does ebb and flow.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you don't stay resilient. That's not the way it works.
Yeah.
It ebbs and flows. There's dark and light. There's joy and struggle. And I think anyone who says any different isn't giving you the whole story. And so there have been dark nights in there. There have been periods, some of them quite long, where it was just a case of, you know, I just have to keep going.
Yeah.
For me, I guess the core focus has always been the fact that it really mattered. It's kind of, it wasn't just what I did, it was who I was. And therefore, all of it mattered. And therefore, to keep going. That's one thing. That the other thing is working with incredible people. And yeah. You know, you don't need everybody to be incredible. That would be fairy tale. But you do need some people to be incredible that you work with, whether they're right there with you every day or whether they're at a distance and you can talk to them. And there is a kind of give and take in the system. Mm-hmm. If once you've established some good collaborators and you're working in a group like that, one of you can be a bit down for a while and the others can carry it. But also it is about actually just keeping going. I mean, and brutally honestly, not having a choice. I became a single parent when the children were very small and in the early years of the foundations of Miru. And actually, I just had to keep working because I had no choice.
Mm-hmm.
And not that I wanted to stop, but actually I'm incredibly aware that in those intensely hard times when it was full on at home and full on at work, I just had to get up in the morning and keep going. So that must sound really, really negative.
No, other people have said the same thing.
But actually, you come through the dark and into the light. And there's patches where it's dark some days and light other days. And it is actually working out of that and being determined to get out of it. And to and then fantastic things happen. You get a paper published that's joyous, or you get a grant you didn't expect you were going to get, or a PhD student flies through their viva and makes you feel just fantastic. And I'm still realizing I haven't come back to answer your question about the WHO, but one of the things that actually really struck me at a point where I was feeling quite stretched thin was an invitation to chair the WHO Maternal and Newborn Strategic Committee
mm-hmm.
in 2002, I think it was, 2003, which was awesome. It was the big strategic multidisciplinary maternal and newborn health committee. And it was my first experience of one of those big WHO committees where everybody sits around a table and around the outside sit the secretariat. You know, there's 50 people in the room and it's microphones and all that kind of stuff. And out of the blue, I got asked to chair it. And part of me is going, don't be silly, you know, I can't do that. Part of me is going, oh, okay, let's go for this. And it was one of those experiences where actually you could just sit there and by being there, make midwifery present.
Yeah.
You know, you could make it really clear that whatever the discussion was about, midwifery was in the room.
Yes.
And in fact, midwifery is holding the microphone. And you can go, okay, this matters. And something very similar happened a bit with the Lancet series, which was, again, it came kind of out the blue to me. I think I was in pole position to do that because everything that had gone before was kind of a foundation for that. And it was partly being in the right place at the right time. But it was also partly that foundation of years of different methodologies, different topics, different approaches that kind of blended together in coming together to be in the right place to do that. And actually, we would need another whole podcast to talk about the formation of the Lancet series and why it matters so much and why we did it the way we did it.
Yeah, I'm happy to arrange that to you to sit and kind of chat about where that sits and the consequences of it.
I think that would be a great thing to do because we had to problem solve. From a researcher's point of view, it was the biggest challenge I have ever done methodologically. And we had to do it together. Mm-hmm. We had to develop consensus as we went. Because we knew if we didn't, it would just sink like a stone and nobody would pay any attention to it. If the WHO walked away from it, if people walked away from it, it wouldn't make a difference. And we wanted it to make a difference.
Mm.
But we also had to sit within very, very rigorous methodological. We had to do very high quality research, is what I'm saying. We couldn't just write, we think midwives are great. No. And we couldn't just describe places where midwives were doing a great job. We had to do something transformative because the problems of midwifery were so great. People really didn't understand what it was. Completely inconsistently implemented from place to place, mm-hmm. and so on and so forth. So we actually had to do something completely transformative and bring 50 people with us and a whole bunch of organizations. So, and it was without a doubt the hardest thing I've ever done. Without a doubt, the thing I'm proudest of. And as you say, it's had an impact and has taken us right through, even to doing a whole new radical set of standards for midwives in the UK now, completely founded on the framework from the Lancet series. So, and governments across the world now implementing midwifery because they're convinced that it makes a difference. So, yeah, it would be great to do another podcast.
We will.
On that, Liz.
We will book that in. But now, what's next? What are your passion projects that get you excited now that you can pick and choose?
Well, interestingly, I finally retired at the end of March 2020.
Timely.
Half retired before then, but I'd filled all my time by doing the work on the standards for the UK. So I arrived at the end of March, pretty shattered, I have to say, with the work I'd been doing on the standards for the previous few years, and thought, okay, now I'm going to rest and relax and take some time to be with the grandchildren. And so a pandemic struck, as everyone will know, at precisely and exactly that time. Mm-hmm. So I got catapulted into a frenetic few months together with some other old profs in the UK to support the Royal College of Midwives by doing the review work around informing the maternity guidelines for the pandemic. Because what we found was that the RCOG was doing a terrific job of doing the maternity guidelines, but they were doing their job. They were doing the obstetric guidelines. That was their job. But what we needed was the bringing in the guidelines that would bring in the evidence for what women needed, for what babies needed, and the midwifery lens and the women's and the baby's lens into those guidelines. So there were a whole bunch of things that needed to be looked at, from the organisation of services to avoid separation, through to infant feeding, how to support women with breastfeeding during the pandemic, and so on and so forth. So we did a set of, I think, about 7 or 8 very rapid but very thorough reviews of the evidence that we then handed over to the joint RCM-RCOG process for the maternity guidelines. And those very quickly found their way through to other countries as well, because at the time, other countries were looking to those guidelines. And so we actually said very clearly, mothers and babies shouldn't be separated, women should be breastfeeding. In fact, one should have community services instead of centralising women into hospitals. We said a lot of things very loudly and very clearly. But that absolutely took over the first few months of my retirement, when in fact I'd been going to work out what I wanted to do. I was going to take a few months to think, what did I want to do? So that was all gone. And by the time I came out the other end of that, we were busy as a group of professors of midwifery and related areas. We were busy doing things together, and we had formed a group that actually then took on a life of its own. And I also worked with another group that actually looked at how to keep education going in the pandemic.
Yep.
And so we very quickly published a paper from that. We did some great case studies. Virtual working has huge strengths, and it meant that we could sit at home and work with people all over the world and do things turning around instantaneously. And what we found in that paper where we were looking at how to keep education going in a pandemic, midwifery education, was astonishing work that people were doing. They had just turned their lives around, midwifery educators, midwifery students, clinical midwives, turned their lives around and done this fantastic work. So we published that paper, and then we then went on our profs group to publish a paper on how to keep quality care going in a pandemic. Mm-hmm. So there's one on quality education in a pandemic and one on quality care in a pandemic. And that was drawing on the learning of all sorts of people from different places. That then took me into another consultancy with the WHO to look at quality education in a pandemic globally. Mm-hmm. And that report has been written, not yet published, but written. And we found some phenomenal case studies from countries across the world, low-income countries, middle-income countries, as well as high-income countries, who had managed to keep education going. Because, of course, you can't just stop educating midwives. You can't just stop the pipeline. Otherwise, you end up with an absolute crisis for women and babies. And so all of that was kind of, it just rolled me along with a life of its own during that time. And then what happened was the UK has moved into the hardest space I think it's ever been since I qualified. And it's there right now. And now is not a time to step back. Mm-hmm. I think now is a time to keep going and to step forward and to try and make sense of the perfect storm that has engulfed UK maternity services.
And it was happening before the Ockenden report, but the Ockenden report has put an absolute microscope.
It's been coming for years.
Yeah.
But in fact, I'd say it's been coming for at least the last 10 years. You could trace its roots back beyond that, but it's been coming at least for the last 10 years with the phenomenal cuts to the health service, the long-standing underfunding of the maternity services and shortage of midwives and of obstetricians, but a critical shortage of midwives. That has built up over several years, during which medicalization also grew. Mm. So there were practices that were brought in over that time, the OAC care bundle being one of them, the stillbirth care bundle being one of them. And, I did actually at one point a few years ago say to one of the obstetricians who'd led one of those care bundles, you know, they're not care bundles. They're actually not care bundles. They're intervention bundles.
Yep.
And what's missing completely from them
is the care.
It's care. And, you know, it's not just about doing this and that and the next thing. It's about, one of the big insights that we pulled out from the Lancet series, it's not just about what you do, it's how you do it. Mm-hmm. And it's who's doing it. And you can't confabulate those things into being the same thing, and you can't just pretend that the what is the only thing that matters. Mm-hmm. And so what we saw over those years before COVID was the bringing in of a kind of intervention focused way of being, some of which did make a difference to outcomes. I'm not knocking it completely. Yeah. I'm not that stuff. It is completely entirely negative. It's not. We need an evidence lens on everything, including interventions. We absolutely do. But it has to be a rigorous evidence lens, and it has to be a balanced evidence lens that brings all the evidence to bear and not some of it. Because then you get an absolutely skewed picture. And that's what was happening before COVID. Then there was COVID, absolute mayhem, basically, for the maternity services. People worked phenomenally and brilliantly to stay afloat, to continue to care for women and babies. But the workforce shortages were just escalated, and the problems were just multiplied. During that time, before and during that time, it also became evident from reviews like Morecambe Bay, mm-hmm. and that things were very badly wrong in some places, not everywhere by any means, but in some places there were pockets of dreadful quality care where women and babies were dying. Women and babies were being damaged, both physically and psychologically, and that was not being acted upon. And so there were pockets of astonishingly bad quality care being identified. And some of this stuff I have to run in my own head alongside the fact that we were doing the standards at that time, over the kind of 2017 through to 2020, I was working on the standards. So, you know, what are the regulatory standards for midwives in this country, in the UK? And so every day, front and centre for my brain and what I was doing, meeting with people, hundreds and hundreds of people across the whole UK, to talk about what midwives should be doing. We're running these stories of really bad quality care. So that was the lens I was seeing them through, was what should be happening and what is happening. Mm. And then the Ockenden review happened, and there was an interim report last year where quite clear signals about what was coming out. And then the final review was published in March this year. And I see the Ockenden review in two parts. One is the description of what was actually happening. Mm-hmm. And that will make any midwife's heart stop.
Oh, yeah.
Happening was traumatic. It was completely unacceptable. It was disempowering and disrespectful in the extreme. There was... you would definitely call it neglect, and you would certainly call it abuse going on, mm-hmm. For women and babies in that system. It was a clear description of system breakdown, absolute system breakdown, where bad decision-making going on by midwives, terrible decision-making going on by obstetricians, but right across the system, it was clear it was... People were unsupported.
Yep.
People weren't properly educated. The system itself had created barriers. Management was not functioning. Total system breakdown. The second part of the report, however, was the recommendations of what should happen next. In fact, what needs to happen next is transformative action across the whole system, informed by evidence, with fantastic support for behavior change and system change, because people can't just change long-standing ways of working. They don't know. You can't just say empower women, listen to women. I mean, they don't know how to do it.
Yeah.
So you actually need a transformative program put in there. Sadly, the recommendations don't live up to that. Some of them are very important, don't get me wrong. But actually, some of the recommendations don't live up to that standard of evidence and transformative action. Some of them don't even derive from what was happening in that trust. And some of them are cut across existing transformation programs, sadly. So the three that would come to mind most easily would be the discontinuing continuity of care. Mm. There's been a huge work over the last decade at least to bring in continuity of care for women. And
evidence supports it on so many different levels.
Absolutely stalled in its tracks. I'm using the word stalled consciously. I like to think it's not stopped. Uh-huh. But for now, absolutely stopped in its tracks. The second one that I think is really hard to justify is saying that all newly qualified midwives should spend their first year in hospital.
Oh,
that works totally against community services and totally against continuity of care, and brings a hospital-based model in as fundamental. And again, there's no evidence that that is going to remotely help. And the third one is centralized fetal monitoring systems in every labor ward.
Yes.
And it's very hard to see where those three recommendations have come from. And it's quite hard to know how to move forward from them. So what we've done, our group of professors, together with a fantastic few other people from clinical management, from obstetrics, from women's advocacy voices, and newly qualified midwives, is bring a group together, and we've published a paper which basically says, you know, Ockenden is a wake-up call. We have to absolutely respond to this, and we must, you know, this must not happen. But the recommendations have to be grounded in evidence, and they have to be accompanied by skills in education, skills in implementation, skills in improvement, skills in change, large-scale change. And so we've published that, and we're following through on that. So the things that are firing me up at the moment are, I suppose, as usual, things going wrong, the injustice and inequality that is so prevalent still, sadly, and the need for evidence to build a platform towards solutions, collaborative, multidisciplinary solutions that you build with other people. Because a whole track of my CV that we haven't talked about at all really is large-scale sustainable change.
I mean, we could easily do a part two.
Over the recent kind of 10, 15 years, I've also worked a lot on large-scale sustainable change, how you bring large numbers of people together to make things different. And so that's what's needed in response to Ockenden. It's not kind of lots of individual piecemeal recommendations. Important as some of those might be, it's much more about transformative, planned, evidence-based, collaborative, multidisciplinary change. That's currently what I'm doing, as well as trying to spend time with four children.
That Ockenden review paper, kind of just pulling it up here, it's got like 19 affiliations, as you're saying, very much collaboration from all over the place and different. And yeah, we have a healthcare system that is multidisciplinary. So whatever issues we have in it, we also have to, the same solutions have to be multidisciplinary. But we also have to take it at government level. We have to take it at executive level, because otherwise we're still going to have continuing midwives at all the other levels kind of underneath that are going to continue to leave. Because as we were saying, kind of mentioned before, the moral distress and the moral injury make people leave.
The moral distress and the moral injury, certainly. The sad thing for me is the juxtaposition, and I don't think it's accidental. On the one hand, we've got a really strong evidence base.
Mm-hmm.
We have, in the UK, we have fantastic radical new standards. There are also global new standards that the ICM has. We have potentially a stronger midwifery profession, both nationally and globally, than we have seen. WHO is out there absolutely determined to implement midwifery globally and working with lots of governments. We're at a really strong point for midwifery globally.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, we have this phenomenal pushback Now, I don't think that's accidental. And I think we have to recognize where we are, therefore, that we are, we can build on strength. We're not nowhere. We're not back in the 70s when there was very little. We can build on strength. We can build on knowledge. We can build on our global networks. We can build on collaborations. But the negatives are very, very, very strong right now. And for whatever reason, the media has picked on midwifery as a scapegoat. The media has decided that midwives and normal birth are at the epicenter of all of this. And although there's no evidence for that, and although what we're seeing is system meltdown, a starving of resources from various government policy decisions, and an over-medicalization and a focus on the what as opposed to the how, although all of that is there, we're going to have to work our way through that. We are going to have to stand up and say clearly and loudly, women, babies, families, all of them, without exception, need midwives. So how are we going to make sure that that quality midwifery is put in place and supported by the system? And everybody is going to have to help with that. That is not a job for midwives to do.
No.
That is a job for everyone. That is a job for our medical colleagues. It's a job for managers. It's a job for policymakers. It's a job for politicians to make sure that quality midwifery is put in place so that all women, all babies, all families can access it, and that there are enough midwives and that they are properly educated and integrated into the system. That is the challenge for the next 20 years of our lives. This is not quick, not a quick fix. And it will be today's students. It'll be your students. It'll be our students who are picking that up and moving forward with that challenge, with a whole new set of challenges, but they will have also a foundation, a stronger foundation to work with, of knowledge, of evidence, of an understanding, if you like, of what's needed.
And that's exciting.
It's exciting. It's terrifying. It's definitely exciting, but we're back to this joy and the struggle. It's the excitement of having that challenge, and I guess the determination that you can't give up at this point. You can't say can't be done. It's too hard. You know, you actually, when you have a challenge that you think is too hard, you have to say, okay, how am I going to do it? If it's too hard for me here, how do I problem solve that? Who do I need to work with me? And how do I, you may have to walk away for a while and then come back to it, all of that. But midwives as a whole will be in this struggle for a while.
Thank you so much for your time.
You're very welcome. It's been a privilege. Thanks very much for inviting me.
Thank you for joining us today. You'll find all the links on Twitter, Instagram, and on the podcast website. If you are a midwife and you would like to share your research, your postgraduate studies, or even the quality improvement projects you are doing now, then email me at throughthepinard@gmail.com. Send me a tweet or send me a DM.